the main ingredient.
Episode of The Main Ingredient with David Mayfield. Today we have a guest that I know personally, I am just, beyond excited to have a chat with. And there's a lot of people in my non-cooking world that I think are just delighted by the fact that I'm going to get the opportunity to speak with Tim Kennedy today.
Hey.
Yeah, Tim. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. And I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, because I mean, I know there's a lot of chefs that follow this podcast, but I mean, you know, former UFC, Green Beret, Sheep Dog Response Readiness. Just the list goes on of the amount of cool shit that you're involved in. And, an up-and-coming chef, a YouTube chef in your own right, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I cook.
Well, I mean, it seems like you definitely have a passion for everything that you do. And I think that's the thing that makes people, at least like me, kind of gravitate towards you and why, you're an interesting person to follow, at least on the worldwide interwebs, because... I mean, everything you do, you approach with a very, the best way to put it is a zeal, right? Like there is a zeal for whether you're training, whether you're rolling, whether you're going out hunting, whether you're barbecuing, whatever it is. And, you know, I have to ask, and I want to start with just the, you know, talking about how do you become what seems like you're an expert at a lot of different things.
So when I started fighting, I was already doing a few different martial arts, Shotokan karate, Japanese jiu-jitsu. I was wrestling. I was boxing. I'd just been introduced to Hawaiian Kempo, Muay Thai, you know, and my dad was a one sport athlete guy, and he was an incredible athlete, as was most of my uncles and my brother and my sister. They were like one sport people. And there was this kind of ever relentless pounding of their words and advice, which was, you know, you're going to be a jack of all trades, but a master of none. And I was like, you know, I get that, but I'm also a prick, second born, might as well have been a redheaded stepchild. And I'm like, I'm going to do exactly opposite of what they told me. And then MMA came along and I was good at wrestling. I was good at boxing. I was good at kickboxing. I was good at everything where if I was going to stand out against the opposing opponent in an octagon, that guy, whatever he wasn't good at, I'm going to be really good at. And, so then by being a jack of all trades, it made me look like an expert at a whole bunch of different things, but I wasn't. I was decent at a bunch of different things, but that guy, he was a master of one thing, and he wasn't good enough at that one thing to be able to defeat all of the other things, you know? And then as I was moving into my occupation, I was a firefighter first, and then I was becoming a police officer when 9/11 happened, you know? And it was the same thing where my dad was like, you know, you kind of need to pick a very specific vein of this. I want to be a forensic psychologist. I want to be like Clarence Starling in Silence of the Lambs. I want to go work for the FBI, but I was doing all of these different things. And, you know, then I watched Americans in New York City look inside of a building that was on fire that a plane had just collided in. And they were making the decision whether they're going to jump to their death or they're going to walk back inside and burn alive. And I was pissed off, and I walked to the recruiter's office, and he's like, well, man, you have a pretty diverse resume here. And I was like, yeah, I'm a mess. He's like, you should be in special forces. I was like, yes, I don't know what that is, but I'm sure it's like the SEALs and the snipers and like a ranger. So can I be all of those things? And they're like, yeah, it's kind of like all of those things. So then I became a Green Beret, which truly are the jack of all trades. And, so, you know, you said zeal and passion, and yeah, I'm sure you've had coffee that wasn't hot, you know.
Yeah, it sucks. It's fucking disgusting.
It either needs to be really cold or it needs to be really hot.
Yeah, choose one.
Champagne. Like, have you ever had like room temperature champagne?
Yeah, you throw it out and pour yourself a nice cold glass.
Exactly. Yeah, it's trash.
Just
right?
move on with it, dude. Life is short, you know?
Yeah, life is short. That is it, precisely. Like, why would I do anything without committed resolve, complete dedication? Like, life is too short. And I love the things that I do, so I want to be good at the things that I do. And yeah, I do a lot of things, but like, life is too short to have soggy Cheerios every day. So, you know, if my Cheerios get soggy, I'm going to throw them down the drain and I'm going to pour a new bowl. You know, and that's like my approach to everything.
You know what? You know, it's funny. And so I don't know whether you kind of know anything about my background, but, you know, I'll always try to work into conversation the fact that, you know, my parents are refugees, you know, and they came to the United States. And, you know, I have a very different perspective of this country, I think, than a lot of people who, sometimes I feel like might take it for granted because they never, they don't know that anything else exists, right? They love to point out things about other countries and be like, oh, well, look at this place. Look what they've accomplished. Look what they do. Look, and I don't think they realize, you know, why people escape places to come here, right? Because of all of the amazing shit that we have here. And I think that that perspective is weirdly very American of, you know, I have something here in front of me. It's not good enough. I want what's better. And I'm going to get that for myself. And I know it's a very like trite comparison, right? Like a bowl of Cheerios, but I feel like that's a very American mentality, which is like, this is fine. I mean, it's doable. If I have nothing else to eat and I'm starving in the world, I'll have that, but I could be having so much better than I'm having right now. And it's like, that's the mindset of like entrepreneurs, right? It's a mindset of like, you know, I could, if there is something better, I'm going to go out there and try and get that. Do you get a sense of that at all?
Oh, for sure. You know, and one of the most reassuring, revitalizing, I don't know, like regenerating passion, like the thing that reignites whatever, you know, because I have essentially a dark, cold, murky soul that's been killed time and time again. Mm-hmm. But then I go these places and I get to see that same fire. I get to see that same hunger. I get to see that same hope for something better. You know, like I, when I say go to the worst places on the planet, you know, when our infamous former president would be like, you know, that's a real shithole. Well, guess what? That's where Tim has to work. And so every time that I'm at one of those places, I see these beautiful people and these beautiful cultures that are struggling, that are starving, that are fighting to live. And they want something better. And, you know, when I come home, like I'm doing everything I can to help them, but then I come home and I carry that same passion, that burden, that onus on my shoulders in, you know, into the way that I approach being an entrepreneur and the way that I try to be philanthropically. And it's the way that I try to be a father. You know, it's like this, I want something so much more, so much better than why would I be happy where I'm at? That's purgatory to me. Like you want to talk about torture. It's like, live the same Groundhog's Day. That's torture. You know, lukewarm anything, soggy anything, like it better be on its way to improvement or it better be in the trash. And I'm going to go hard in the paint at everything I do always.
Yeah.
For that reason.
Well, so listen, there's so many things that I want to unpack with you today and I want to be cognizant of time. But so the first thing I do want to talk about is, and we've kind of already broached this, is, you know, your background, you know, as a service member of our military, which, you know, first of all, I know that it's easy to thank you, right? Like I'm sure people all thank you so much for your service, but it's like, I always, you know, and this is something I've talked about on the podcast, right? Like I live in Maine on Maine of progressivism, right? Like here in the Bay Area, it's like, it's honestly, it's an episode of Portlandia every day. Right. And I have a very, complex. I have very complex feelings about politics and how things are done, and they don't really fall in any political camp necessarily. But I think that it's always very easy for us to kind of say like, oh, thanks for your service. But we never know exactly what we're thanking the person for, because frankly speaking, none of us who haven't been there know anything about it. And very rarely do we ever actually ask people like, hey, what do you think actually about this, in the sense of what is the right way or the wrong way, right? Like, we all have opinions because it's very easy to have an opinion on the sideline, right? You're watching the person on the battlefield, and you have all sorts of criticisms about how things could have been done better, whether drones should have been used, all these different things, right, that everyone loves to have opinions about, but they really don't know the full story. And it's probably better that they don't know the full story. But I guess my question to you is, as someone who you know has been in the service for as long as you've been, and who continues to go back to that well, continues to, you know, give everything you have to the country, in your perspective, like, where are we at? Because I know that I have a lot of friends who have, you know, who have been in the service through multiple presidencies, and there is a very, you know, like, if you ask them sometimes, I think progressives would, I don't know, it's like they're not going to want to hear the answers of sometimes like that maybe certain things in the service got better for folks under Donald Trump, or, you know, and maybe vice versa, because, you know, we don't know. Like, one of the things that I heard was that the VA got significantly better during Donald Trump's presidency. Can you speak to kind of the sense, and I'm not asking you to get like political in that, you know, like who's better, who's worse, or whatever, but just I guess talk about the things that we as everyday citizens take for granted and don't really understand.
Yeah. Well, you know, you brought up some really kind of brilliant, sensitive points. It's like, oftentimes we don't want to hear an idea or an opinion that is going to conflict with the one that we have. There's the same reason that we follow people on Twitter and Instagram that share our same opinions and beliefs, so that I can be in an echo chamber of my own ideas. And, you know, like I said earlier, that's purgatory to me. I never want to be in an echo chamber of anything. I want new, I want fresh, and I want passion. So the military, you know, I have served under President Bush. I had the privilege of meeting him after we killed the number two bad guy on the planet in Iraq, named Zarqawi. And he was the number one bad guy in Iraq. And he was the one that was hanging Americans from bridges and setting them on fire. Really the center of gravity for all terrorism in Iraq. I got to be part of the task force that killed him. And President Bush came in to shake our hand for no purpose. There was no press. There was no picture. There was no anything. I think Bush has now been embraced as a man kind of the people, and he was trying to do the right thing. But at the time, a lot of people, he was a very polarizing president, and a lot of people were like, weapons of mass destruction, they're there, they're not there, we're there for oil. But as a soldier on the ground with the American flag on my arm, it doesn't matter who the president is. I have a job to do, and I'm there to, you know, I raise my hand to swear to uphold and protect the Constitution, foreign, domestic, and follow the orders of my commanders and their chain of command. And when I am there doing that, this is the most difficult thing to try to explain to somebody that has never been in the military. It's that the way that we measure success exclusively has to be about capability. And for the military, capability means lethality. Either we are more lethal and we are more capable of fighting our country's wars, we are more capable, we are more lethal in keeping our opponents at bay, or we are waning. It's either one or the other. There's no constant middle ground. There's no garrison safety. We are either preparing to keep the wolves at bay, or we are the best way, the best thing to fight a wolf. And in a time right now where we are surrounded by wolves, and it's like, let's not split hairs. I don't care what you believe. We have enemies right now that are doing everything they can, both economically and militarily, So we use this DIME, D-I-M-E, diplomatic, information, military, and economic. And those are the kind of the four ways that you can conduct warfare. A big war has all four of them. Sometimes it's just information. Sometimes, like with China for the past 15 years, it's 20 years, it's just been economic. With Russia, it's been on and off between all four of them and at periods of times. Like during the Cold War, it was two of them. Well, we're very close to being at all four of them with a few different countries right now. And
sorry, let me interrupt for 1 second. Where does cyber fall into that?
Cyber would fall into information.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yep. So each one of those, like diplomatic, that blows up into non-government entities, organizations, NGOs, to Department of State. Militarily, obviously, that's pretty clear. Information, that could be cellular, that could be satellite, that could be cyber, that could, you know, that each of those categories has many subcategories to expand into how you wage war. But are you more lethal, more capable, or less lethal, less capable? And, 8 years under President Obama compared to President Bush, we'll just use ammunition for training. If under Bush, I had 1 million rounds of ammunition to train with, under President Obama, I would have half of that. And I'm just using bullets as an example because that, I think, paints an accurate picture. But that is all funding, and that is all support across the board. If I'm going to try and buy a new rifle or a new optic or a new drone, my maneuverability and ability is always constrained by what does the administration want to do. So at the very top, you have the president, and the president creates his strategic guidance. That strategic guidance goes down to all of the different secretaries of. So Secretary of Defense takes his, and he reads that document, and then he interprets what the president wants, and then he passes that down to his subordinates, the Department of State, the CIA, every single group, appointed person, takes that, appointed by the president, approved by Congress, takes that document, and then they write down what they're supposed to do in their lane. That strategic guidance is all the way down to the lowest level, down to an operator on the ground, is a really powerful thing. Right now, we are in a really weird position because the military, for the first time, is being leveraged for political purposes. We joke that the military got woke. The military can't be woke. The military has no business in inclusion, in any racial disparities. There's not a single commander ever, anytime ever, anywhere on the planet right now that is going to look at a bunch of people and be like, okay, well, I'm only going to take these seven white guys because these seven white guys are the best. If the black guy does the best war fighting, 10 out of 10 times, he's going to take the black guy. Not that he's black, he doesn't care. He only cares that the best is who he's going to pick. Same with the pilots, same with the cooks. Race, gender, all of that is gone. All that matters is capability, lethality. And right now, we have groups and organizations that are playing with these social issues and trying to use the military as an avenue or conduit to affect change. And that's dangerous. And it's dangerous all the time, but it's extra dangerous right now when we know that there are people positioning to do us harm. So yes, the VA is better. Yes, I had a lot of bullets under President Trump. Yes, I had all of the funding. You know, if you're a Taliban and you shoot or a rocket at my guys, I don't get to use a bomb to blow you up. I get to use the biggest bomb in the whole entire arsenal to drop on top of your head. That's a different thing. That's a different type of authority and support. And that goes a really long ways with boots on the ground.
So let me ask you this. Okay. And let's kind of like feed the beast just slightly here. Is there anything, and I'm truly asking from the most ignorant standpoint ever, and I don't know what answer I'm going to get here, but is there anything in your mind that gets better for you practically in your military life when, you know, a president that I voted for, Joe Biden, gets into office?
In the military?
Yes.
No. No.
And it's just kind of that black and white, where if you're in the military, you're like, listen, my life is just easier. It's more practically, it's just practically applicable to me that when a Republican is in office, my life is just, it's better as a service member.
Yeah, I don't think there would be a very, very, very small percentage of service members that would say otherwise. That when a Republican is office, and I do not like Republicans. there's only, I think, about six of them that I'm like, all right, that doesn't sound crazy. But as a military member, I cannot think of a single one of my friends, one of my colleagues, one of my associates that wouldn't second the sentiment that when a Republican is in office, that their job in the military is easier and more achievable, and success is more possible.
See, so that's, you know, and I just want to take a second because I don't want that to get glossed over, right? Because I think there's something to that, right? To understand that there's a privilege that comes along with kind of getting to stand on the sidelines and point your finger and say, oh, well, you know, like, you know, kind of, if from the book, I can write this book, right? And in the book that I write, I can spout off all these like really, you know, nice things, you know, these really idealistic things. But like, if the book doesn't work in practice, nobody gives a shit about the book. The book's going to end up on the shelf. Nobody's ever going to, it's like a recipe, right? I don't care how cool the chef is. Whereas if I try one of the recipes and the recipe doesn't work for me, I'm never picking up that book again. And I think the one thing that you said, which kind of like, you know, at least for me resonates, is the fact that you look at it kind of soberly, socially at a lot of the Republicans in the Republican Party today and some of the shit that they're saying, and some of the acts that they're doing, and in a lot of ways, it makes you look and kind of like, it's kind of cringeworthy stuff. You're looking at them, and you're like, why would you say that? Like, that's not, and that's actually a great segue into like one of the other conversations I want to have about something that you had mentioned on your social media, which is toxic masculinity, and I think you and I will definitely have a lot of stuff that kind of we agree upon there, but it's interesting when you say like, hey, you know what, in your life, if you're not out on a battlefield, you may have the privilege to kind of align yourself with people who you think kind of idealistically with, but they don't actually impact your life from a real practical sense, right? Like, the president doesn't impact my life from a practical sense. I vote because I look at them and I say, oh, well, you know what? Like, I want my kids to look at that person and say, you know, as they gesture and as they speak and as they are, and say, you know what? That's a person you can look up to, right? Which for me, when I looked at Donald Trump, it's just not someone I could say that to my daughter and say, look at that person, you can look up to them, right? But for you, there is no privilege where you get to look at that and be like, oh yeah, you know, you know, it kind of just doesn't stop and start there. There's so much more of a practical application, right?
Yeah, man. So when I walk in the front doors of my work, on the wall is a picture of the chain of command. So there's eight pictures there. And the top one is the president. And it's not the last president. It's not the president that I like. It's not the president maybe that I voted for. It's the president that is sitting in office,
right?
And he is in his freaking picture is on the wall, and he is in my chain of command. He gets to say things like, right now, if President Biden walked out on to the stage in his press conference, he got in front of that microphone and he said, there's been conflicts in the Ukraine, I have mobilized our special operations unit, I'm gonna have to end this call right now, and I'm gonna have to go pack my bags, man,
right?
Like, that is how immediate what that man wants to do affects me, my life, and my family. And while that might be an extreme example, it is a real example. And that example has happened thousands of times in history. In my life alone, and in my time in the service, that has happened, I don't know, like 50 times,
right,
where the things that he wanted to do affected what I ultimately have to do on the ground. And that has gone from Bush to Obama, Obama to Trump, Trump to President Biden. And we are not afforded the privilege. We're not afforded the, as you said, the sideline perspective of, I get to sit here and watch what happens. I don't get to watch
Monday morning quarterback, right?
Yeah.
No, totally.
Well, no, I mean, that's like a talented person. I'm more of like the water boy on the sidelines.
That's some high quality H2O. Yeah. All right. So I do want to transition here because you said something on your social media recently, and it resonated with me in a serious way. And I think people are very afraid to talk about it, at least, you know, here in San Francisco and in more progressive places. Nobody wants to say this because it's definitely not a popular sentiment right now, right? And you kind of called out the term toxic masculinity as a bullshit term recently when you were talking about the idea of your viewpoint of what, you know, your role is in the life of the females around you, right? And that your statement was pretty much like, if you do anything that would A, degrade, harm, humiliate, violate, a woman in your life or around you or in your kind of like periphery or whatever, that is not masculine. That's the opposite. That's cowardness, right? Like that's, and I don't want to say the opposite of masculinity is cowardness because the opposite of masculinity is femininity, right? But that is not, has nothing to do with masculinity. That is cowardness. That's a person who is twisted and completely fucked up and devoid of any, devoid of masculinity, really. Right. And I was wondering if you can kind of talk a little bit about this term toxic masculinity, which is, it's become, you know, very fashionable to use and to label, I mean, just certain men acting like pieces of shit.
Yeah. I mean, it's convenient. And you know, it's one of the beautiful things about podcasts is that you get to have the nuanced conversations about the subtleties of and layers of a thing. You know, so to be a man is a powerful thing. You know, but you don't get to be gentle unless first you're strong. You know, as a father of three daughters and a husband to a beautiful wife, I can go and pick up my 18-month-old daughter, you know, who is just squishy and beautiful and precious in every single way. I can pick up 600 pounds off the ground. I can take a man and put him through the wall. I can wear his skin as a birthday suit. That is, I mean, I'm capable of violence that you have never seen. And I pray to God that you'll never see, but with the capability of violence, I mean, you've seen it in like little under rule sets in the octagon where I'm covered in my own blood or my opponent's blood as I just knocked him out or choked him unconscious. And that is a sport. That is a vastly different thing than what I can do overseas. But even with all of that capability, with that lethality, every time that I've ever touched any one of my children, they know without a shadow of a doubt that it is from tenderness, it's from compassion, it's with care, and with its love. So gentle, you can't be gentle unless you're first strong. You know, the intentionality of trying to be a protector and trying to be a provider, that comes from a beautiful position of what it means to be a man. And the abomination of what a man is now is a dangerous thing. And it's I don't know where it came from, and I don't know why we want our men to be feminine. I don't know why we want our men to be soft. I want my men to be gentle, but first they have to be strong. First they have to be powerful. First they have to have the capability to protect. And if that capability isn't there, if all of that masculine energy has been directed in some unhealthy way, in some unhealthy act, if you look at the mass shooters, if you look at the school shootings, you see a common theme. You see a very scary, underdeveloped, dangerously feminine man. You see somebody that has been stunted. You see somebody that has been the natural process of them.
Well, they look weak, right? Normally when you see them, they look weak.
They look fragile.
Right.
And a fragile man is a dangerous thing. you know, but I walk down the halls of giants. I'm to my left and to my right. I'm standing by protectors, that heroes that will jump on top of a grenade that lands in that room in a heartbeat, that will throw. And I've seen them firsthand throw themselves in front of little children on the battlefield to protect them before they run off to go do more. Like if a bomb goes off, the first thing that they're going to think about is who is near me that I have to protect. Then I'm going to go stop the guy that's doing this. And there's nothing they can do because that's the way that their brains are wired. And me being a 5-year-old kid on the playscape at the North County Christian School in Atascadero, California, when that little boy walked up to my friend Laura LeCary, and she had a little short haircut, and he said, "You look like a boy, Laura, ha 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 ha." And I followed him up to the top and I cracked him in the mouth and I pushed him off and it broke his arm and I got paddled by the principal. You know, and it was like every spanking, I was like, "That's right, man. You know, nothing's going to change here." Cause I know what I, you know, I get home and I get high five from my dad knowing that I did the right thing, you know, and like so, my sister, she's untouchable. My 18-month-old daughter, I saw a yellow jacket land on the trampoline and I saw my 6-year-old run over. He's been stung by a yellow jacket. He knows what that pain feels like. And without a moment of hesitation, he ran over to protect his little sister. And those are the moments that have to be embraced. Those are the moments that have to say, "Yes, that is what you're supposed to do, son. You look amazing. Thank you for doing that. You are the best big brother."
So I want to parse this a little bit because I know I'm going to get a lot of blowback on this. And that's precisely why I brought you on, honestly, because I really don't want this, you know, my life is similar to what you said before, right? Like I don't need an echo chamber in my life. I am completely capable of hearing people with different opinions than mine, disagreeing with them super cordially and having a discussion. I agree with everything you're saying, but I think sometimes it's easy to pervert a message like yours as being either chauvinistic or non-inclusive or something like that. And I do want to let you clarify something. I don't think what you're saying is that there's no room or space for the respectful inclusion of people who find themselves in a, you know, wanting to be feminine or wanting to not be referred to as a man, even if they were, you know, biologically born that way, right? Like, I don't think you're saying that, right?
No, I absolutely did say that. You can be whatever you want. But it's your choice. This is not society dictating what version of a man I'm supposed to be.
Right.
And if you want to be, you know, David, you're like, "Hey, I want to be referred to as this." God bless you. I will call you anything you want. I will support you. I will make right. a cake out of hemp, and I will wear a rainbow flag at your wedding. And I don't give two shits, because that's what it means to be an American.
Right.
And that's also what it means to be a man. And if I'm walking down and I see two gay men holding hands and I see a redneck look over at him like, "Hey, fags, get off the street." Like, am I going to look at the gay guys and be like, "Hey, you're in the wrong place"? No, I'm going to crack the, like, that big
right.
in the mouth.
Well, and that's part of being a defender too, right? A protector of all people, right? Like if you look at innocence
Absolutely.
And you're like, you're innocent and that other asshole is not innocent, you're going to protect the innocence regardless of race, color, creed, gender, or anything, right?
Without a shadow of a doubt. It doesn't matter if you're reading the Quran on the street corner or you're reading the Bible on the street corner, you're going to get the same love for me as your right to do that thing wherever that is. I don't care your color. I don't care anything about you besides that you have the freedom to do it and it's your choice to do it. And as a man, it is my duty and my obligation to use the strength that I was born this way. And it would be dangerous. I know, because there were periods of time where I didn't use this energy in a very healthy way, where I was fighting, I was selfish. This was before I was in the military, before I knew where I wanted to be. And, you know, like that misguided energy could have ended with me in prison. But instead, I embraced what it meant to be a man. And, you know, my wife, who's a brilliant MBA, she's a CFO for a couple of different boards, and
she's a boss lady.
She is a vicious feminist. and if you think I could walk in there and take a degree of chauvinism and be like, okay, well, you know, this is what I think we should do. I'm the head of the household, or any of those, you know, outdated, antedated ideas. Like, there's not a place for it. But anything that she wants, I'm going to be standing by her side as a good partner to support. Even if that means that she wants to work in the kitchen and that is her choice and that's what she wants to do, I'll support her in wanting to do that. Or it's her going and putting on a beautiful silk blouse and walking into the boardroom and be like, hey, dudes, you guys are all messed up. Your PLs were jacked up this quarter. If we don't see a change next time, you're all going to be fired. I'll be like, yeah, that's my girl. What up?
Her. Right.
You know?
So, and I'm glad we had a chance to kind of like talk about that, because I think that it can get painted with too broad of a brush. And especially, I think social media, unfortunately, is a very crude way of communicating. I think it's getting better with the long form videos. I think Twitter is never going to get fixed, in the sense of you cannot be nuanced in 100 and whatever characters. And you brought it up earlier. You know, that's why I love podcasts, because you can have a nuanced conversation and get different degrees of texture into things. Because I think that the one of the things you brought up, which is super important, which is, you know, the American way is not about inflicting your way of being so everyone has to do it. It's the freedom to live your life your way without other people inflicting their way on you, right? And to slide the pendulum to the other side to basically say, well, I was once afflicted with this, you know, with society's stereotypes and not allowing me to walk down the street. So now the pendulum needs to swing to the other direction, doesn't fix anything either, right? Like, that's the problem with pendulums. Usually they need to be right in the middle. and anytime they're too far to one side or another, it promotes there being a level of unfairness, right?
Yeah. You know, balance, and that's one of the great things about freedom. And that's what one of the great things about beautiful, you know, and feminine does not mean weak.
Right.
Masculine does not mean exclusively strong. These are complementary things that, you know, whether it's like, I don't know what you believe spiritually or religiously or like, but the visual representation of like the yin yang and every single balance that you've ever seen. When you look at the cultures of warriors, going back to the Spartans, even though they had their weird things, the samurai, they had their weird things. But what you saw was men that were so talented at violence, but they're poets and that they were philosophers and they were sculptors. They had Zen gardens, you know, they had the watercolor paintings of landscapes of waves crashing on the shore. And, you know, that was balance and that was beautiful. And the inverse of that, the women of those cultures, as sometimes inaccurately painted in current literature and definitely in film, those are powerful women. They were, you know, it's Spartan women were not to be
trifled with. Yeah.
And women of samurai culture, like, they were brilliant and they were the center of gravity of that household.
Even going back to like Viking culture, right? Like, I mean, you know, the maidens, the Viking maidens, the shield maidens, right? Like, they were on the fucking battlefield. They were voyagers too. They were out there stabbing motherfuckers and pillaging and doing their thing. You know, and I think it is strange that, you know, there has been this... So let me ask you that. And I think this is a really good question, because you might have feelings, you probably certainly have feelings about this. Why is it then that in our modern military, we have such an issue with women going to battle?
So you have to measure first, David, how do we measure success of women going to battle? Should they be there? And if so, why? You tell me.
Well, so you're asking me for my opinion, right? And this is an opinion of someone who has no experience. So
yeah.
My opinion is, I do believe they should be there, because if they want to be, and then they can pass whatever level of physical barriers there are to being able to go there, then I don't see there to be a reason why they shouldn't be allowed to go if they want to serve in that way.
Ooh, I love all of that. And I agree fully with that, but I'm going to add one more thing. And I hope that you agree. So they want to be there. They can pass all of the standards without those standards being changed.
Right.
And three, it contributes to the lethality of the force.
Right.
You have to include that. And if that's not included, then what you're doing is you're playing social games with our military again. You want women to be on the front lines because you think that they should be there. The only reason that a pilot should fly a plane is because he's the best person to fly that plane. The only reason that person should be on the wall, and that wall separates hell, fire, fury, anarchy, and chaos, and provides protection from everybody on the other side of the wall. The only reason that person should be on the wall, because they're the best person to be on that wall.
Right. And now, and you will get no argument from me on that. Like my sense of it is that, you know, I am one of those people that do believe, you know, and once again, like, this is not a very vogue belief, at least where I live, that men and women are different. They're different. You know, and any amount of science and doctors out there and data points will bear that out. Not better, not worse, but they happen to be better and worse, you know, statistically at different things.
Yeah.
And I think that I agree with you. It is awesome. And I think that we are somewhere where we're trying in some way to steal some of the things that, you know, different people are just inherently better at sometimes. And I don't think that it has to be a bad thing, but we're getting down this road where it's a zero sum game, right? It's like, well, if all people can't compete in this one sport, then why should anybody compete? Well, I mean, but that's the thing, right? Like, you know, for example, I'll give you a great example. If Gabby Garcia wants to go train in the men's division at ADCC, and she's like, yo, I want to do it because I'll fucking smash these people, I almost am like, well, she's not wrong. She will probably smash the majority of the dudes in ADCC. But that's a very particular case of a woman who will dominate people, and you look at her and you look at her body of work and you understand that. And I think that there's nuance in these conversations, and there's always an exception to the rule. But if you were to put, I don't know, like Bea Mesquita in the, you know, in the same category as, let's say, like, you know, Buchecha, she's probably going to get smashed.
Yeah.
And that's probably too inside baseball with the jujitsu for most people that listen to this podcast.
Yeah. So I will use a broader picture of what's the heaviest division of the UFC for females?
For females, I mean, it's
like 145 or something.
After 145, it's open, right?
Amanda Nunes is the champion of the two top divisions, the two heaviest divisions, which is 135 and 145, I think, or 145 and 155. Now, it's not if she fights somebody of her same weight class, because we have rules in the UFC. We're talking about war. And at war, I'm going to take Francis Ngannou, the heavyweight, and I want 50 Francis Ngannous.
Jesus Christ, that sounds scary.
That's what I want, right? And maybe I'm going to take a couple of John Joneses if he keeps packing on some muscle. And, you know, maybe I'm going to take a couple of our Clydes and our Alistair Overeems. But, like, they're distant second choices for me. Because I want the guy that's the biggest, the strongest, the fastest, and the most dangerous. And that is the lens that I'm measuring success through.
Right.
So to go back to your first question of, okay, they want to be there. They can pass the physical requirements without that being changed. And not to date has that ever happened. So, and I'll use Ranger School as the easiest example. If we'll call, you're a girl and I'm a guy. We both go to Ranger School together. On paper, for you to pass, you have to get a 70% on your PT test. I have to get a 70% on my PT test. So when we both finish at 70%, we're going to tell the world that you and I passed the same. because we both got 70%.
Right.
But here's the trick. We have different PT tests. I have to be able to do 70 push-ups. You have to be able to do 50. I have to do 73 sit-ups. You have to do 51. I have to run a 13:30 on my 2 mile to get a max. You only have to run a 14:30. So in what world is that the same standard?
Right.
But what I report to Congress is that young lady passed the same standard that that man did. That's not true. That's a bold-faced lie. You manipulated the you manipulated the vernacular to be able to say that we both passed at a 70%, which is true, but that we met the same standard is not true. And not that there's women out there that can't do it. And if there are, I welcome them to come and pass. But then when we go to war, and this is the very scary thing, we historically have examples where we can look and we can say, does a male unit perform better than a female unit? Yes or no? Yes, they perform better. They are. So we have these tasks. They're called METAL, Mission Essential Task Lists. And every single one of our units has a METAL. And we measure that unit's success by their ability to conduct their METAL. Now, with that Mission Essential Task List, if we look at gender, we the exact same unit with the exact same METAL, male to female, males perform it better. This is war fighting. I'm not talking about any other jobs. Now right. We do just a female unit compared to a mixed gender unit. The mixed gender unit does better or does worse than the all female unit. The female unit will beat out a unit that has a few boys and a few girls in it.
But fascinating. Always, why is that?
The social dynamics here. Chemistry changes. The men do different things. They are focused on different things. Israel really has the most comprehensive studies that demonstrate this because they have all female combat units, they have all male combat units, and they have mixed gender combat units. So if you're looking for historical references, this is not me talking out of my butt. This is us having researched this. Okay, if we have women coming to special forces, how do we do this? Now, I loved what you said, that there are women that come with talents and skills that I will never possess, and we have to embrace those and figure out the best way to use them. But does that mean that I'm going to remove my requirements of lethality and capability and how I measure a military unit? Don't play social justice, because these are men's and women's lives on the line. Does it make them more lethal or less lethal? And that is the only thing that you can judge success about, whether there should be anyone in that position. And when I said that I don't care about female race, about gender, about religion, that is so true. If there's a Muslim that is better at this job, make every single person there a Muslim. If there's a black guy
By the way, wouldn't you want a few Muslims with you in a Muslim country to basically give you some guidance if they're just as good? You know, it's like, I think that's like another thing that kind of like gets looked over, which is like, you want the best expertise too with you in these situations. It's not, you know, and so like, if this was the CIA we were talking about, and we're talking about agents, right? Like, it actually would behoove you to have a number of women agents, right? Because in certain situations, women will get into scenarios that men are incapable of getting, right? Because it's a very targeted thing.
Depends on the mission.
Right.
And that's why our METAL, our Mission Essential Task List, you have specific units that do specific things. Like, I'm not going to send a bunch of Marines into a hospital to try and provide care, right? I'm going to take a bunch of Marines. I'm going to put them on an amphibious boat. I'm going to have them run up a beach and kill every bad guy on the top of that cliff. Or I'm going to take a bunch of Rangers and I'm going to tell them to climb cliffs in Normandy and, you know, keep fascism at bay. But we're back to, and I could not agree with you more, and I 100% agree with you, it's whatever you just listed, something that added capability. Don't you want somebody that will be able to do this thing? Yes, I do. But I don't want somebody, because society or because you or because Congress says that they should be there, should be there. That's not the reason. I'm going to judge if that person should be there, whether they should be there. Do they add capability? Do they add lethality? And if they don't, they should not be there, regardless of race, regardless of gender, regardless of religion. They should not be there.
Well, listen, I want to move on from this topic because, like I said, I want to be cognizant of your time, and there's a couple other topics that I really want to talk to you about. And you know, I'm going to kind of get into your business, what you've become an entrepreneur at, and you know, it's kind of preparedness, right? Would you say that's a good kind of all encompassing term for what you do and what Sheepdog Response is all about?
Yes. Preparedness. I like that.
So here's my thing is, like, I think it's something that I've really started to become very much more interested in and paying way more attention to over the past few years. You know, I've always had the willingness to want to learn what it took to just be self-sufficient. But I think over the past couple of years, I've definitely just started to take those steps, right? And learning, you know, firearms training, whether it's learning how to live off the grid in certain ways, growing your own vegetables, harvesting your own meat, certain things like that. But I want to know, in your perspective, right? Like, let's say, like, you know, somebody's listening to this podcast right now. They're living in a very metropolitan area, and they're excited about learning more about this, yet they don't know how to start, right? They've never been hunting. They don't have a fishing pole. They don't have a garden. They don't know how to get started owning a firearm or anything about that, right? Like, in your perspective, like, how do you start walking down that path?
Well, if you're going to eat an elephant, you know, you start with one bite. And it's no different with this. You know, I think you look at this preparedness thing as this daunting, insurmountable mountain, and it's just not true. So I want 1% better, 1% tougher, 1% stronger, 1% more prepared, 1% better positioned than I was yesterday. And that might mean I spent a little time, if I'm, you know, in a metropolitan urban, I spend a little time researching where is the closest medical facility. If I have a diabetic child, where do I get insulin? How much can I keep in on hand, and how long what is the shelf life? It might be that if I ran 2 miles yesterday, I run 2.1 miles today. It might mean that I go to yoga, you know, 2 days a week, but I'm just improving 1%. And if you're starting at the start line and you've never been down this road before, like, 1% is really, really, really achievable. I'm going to use a really weird example of me shooting right now. So when my gun comes out of my holster, it takes about 0.95 seconds for me to see what I want to shoot, for my hand to go to my holster, pull my gun out, bring my front sight post in alignment with my eyes, line them up, and squeeze the trigger and have that bullet go where I want it to. So just shy of a second. And I can do that all the time, just shy of a second. I want to be faster than that. And I'm fighting for tenths of a second, not 1%. I mean, like, 1% would be awesome. At this point, I'm like, I'm trying for like 0.001. And so at the beginning, at the start of all this, like, if you don't know how to learn how to, if you don't know how to purify water, how do you purify water? Can I take a few drops of chlorine and leave it on a couple of jugs of water, and that will be drinkable water? If I'm in a boil pan and I have an electric range oven and my electric range doesn't work, how do I purify water? Well, there's answers to all of this. It's one of the cool things about being in the 21st century is so, everything is.
But I want to interrupt you with something, because I think, and that's the issue, is there's answers to questions, but if you don't know what the questions are, you can't find the answers. So for example, you just said a bunch of stuff that, like, even me being someone who follows people like you and probably like 12 or 13 other people in your kind of like line of work, I didn't even think about those things to ask, like, you know, for example, you know, how to purify water if I can't boil it. Like, I have a few jugs of water and I keep that, but I don't think about those other questions, or, you know, obviously I don't have a diabetic kid, but in your mind, like, so for example, those are questions that I think people take for granted because they don't actually even know what questions to ask to go get the answers of.
So, but when you start, that's the greatest thing about research, right? That's I started like doing cooking blogs, when I was in the military. I was like 23, 24 years old. And I was talking about, doing a goat cheese marinara appetizer. And I am not joking you, on my video, I opened a jar of, it was like ragu or something. I was like, all right, so you take your marinara base, which is my can of marinara sauce, right? And then you like saute some vegetables and you do some onions and you put that in here. And then you take your cheese and you stick in the oven and like, yala, you have this goat cheese marinara dip. Like, yeah, that's true. But now looking back, I'm humiliated and embarrassed that was the case. But back then I thought that was a really great thing. So then how did I go from there to where I am now, which was this gradual improvement, was spending time on it.
Right.
Like if I go to the store and I grab a survival book, I don't even know what my questions are right now, but by chapter one, I'm going to have a whole list of things. I'm going to be Googling people. I'll be like, and one of the bummer things right now is there's a bunch of charlatans. There's a bunch of liars that are trying to sell snake oil. But there are some masters out there that do incredible work that that have dedicated their lives to preparedness. And it is all at the tips of your fingers and getting the right questions to ask. You know, like the more you learn, the more you know that you don't know. Have you heard that statement before? Like more that you learn, the more you realize you don't know.
Well, in more crude kitchen talk, it's the more you know, the more you learn, the more you know you don't know shit.
But you learn what you need to know, and that's the process,
right?
And it's no different with preparedness. It's no different with being a protector. You know, it's like I am going to make sure that I'm gonna have the right questions. I'm gonna have the right answers. I don't have them right now, but I will. And it doesn't take a long time to get them.
So if you were to kind of break it down into, let's say, five actionable steps that someone listening to this podcast today could be like, hey, this is going to be my first five steps that I'm going to take from being someone who, A, you know, maybe has interest in all this, but doesn't own a firearm, doesn't understand self-defense, doesn't have a bug out bag, like and nothing like that. None of the basic stuff. Yep. First five actionable steps. I'm going from a complete novice with some level of interest to five steps from now. What would you say those are?
One, improve yourself as an individual. So, if you don't exercise at all, if you don't eat clean, you know, the first people to die in whether it's a pandemic or, civil unrest or a zombie apocalypse, it will be the weak outliers. So you as an individual, be the best version of yourself. So that's first. One, be the healthiest version of yourself. Two is identify the most dangerous, the most likely things that could happen. So if you live in a city, that might be losing power. So what are you going to do if you lose power and you're going to have to cook your food at your house? You're going to have to purify water. You know, like that seems like the most likely thing. The most dangerous would be, you know, civil unrest, you know, riots, which you know, of course could include losing power. And so identifying your threats, then identifying your weaknesses. So when you look at you, what are the things that, when I say you, your situation, you know, if I'm going to add another lock, if I'm going to add another hinge, if I'm going to add, you know, a chain, a deadbolt, those are all things that we can do really inexpensively and we can Google and YouTube how to do it, but we just have to spend the time and a little bit of intention to improve it. Then it would be, where am I going to go? if the vulnerabilities that I have here are such that it is not sustainable for me to survive past insert, every situation is going to be different. You know, I can live on my land here for like, I don't know, 6 months, maybe. I have land, I have freezers of food, I have generators, I have a well that it has self power, I have solar. You know, you could shut everything off and I'm like, this is fun. You know, like finally I don't have to go to work today. But every situation is going to be different and I have vulnerabilities. They're not the same vulnerabilities that somebody has in the middle of a downtown San Francisco, but they're different vulnerabilities. And then, you know, last is be able to protect and defend yourself. You know, that might be taking a martial art. That might be learning how to safely own and the responsibility of owning a firearm. That might be, you know, learning how to use a weapon or barricade you and your family, you know, like in building something that will facilitate protecting you and yours. I think those would be the five immediate to-dos.
So one thing that I did not hear you bring up, and I wonder, you know, how much you think this plays a role in it, is like knowing how to feed yourself, right? Like, you did bring up the, like, how do you cook your food, right? But like, hunting and gardening and being off the grid and stuff, do you feel like that's kind of like multiple layers removed from something? Because it's probably not immediate, right? Like it's not, if you're in a disaster situation, you're not going to be like, well, how do I start a garden right now? I'm assuming that's probably why that's not a part of your immediate plan.
No, it is. So in your vulnerabilities, identifying your vulnerabilities, that is not a vulnerability in my world, right? Like I hunt, I have vegetables, I have chickens, I have herbs. And so when I look at vulnerabilities, if the, in that evaluation, in that vulnerability assessment, if I go, I would last 2 days with the food that I have in here, that's a problem. And I have to fix that problem. But the way that you fix that problem in the city is different than the way that I'm gonna fix the problem out here in Texas.
Right.
So, I would put that into that category. Like it is absolutely a very important thing, but it's the solutions to that problem, to that liability are so varied that, you have to identify what that vulnerability is for you and address it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know how I would do it if I lived in an apartment. Like, I can't grow enough vegetables on a windowsill to feed my family. You know, like,
yeah, totally. And I'll tell you, like, that I think has become one of my biggest problems with living in the city is, you know, I live in an apartment and I find myself thinking about preparedness a lot over the past few years. And I'm constantly thinking about stuff like, okay, well, if there is civil unrest, right? And I need to, you know, get from the apartment to the car, like, what is the route that I'm going to take, right? Like, or if we don't have food, you know, like what am I going to do about that? What's the route out of the city if I need to get out of the city? All those different things. And it just makes you start thinking about like, man, living in more rural areas or in like the suburbs rather, you know, even you start thinking to yourself like, I don't know, maybe that is a better, you start like, maybe I want to get out of the city now, you know?
Yeah. So there's a, one of my buddies, he was a Special Forces 18 Delta. He has an Instagram page called the Ready Man Network. It has two things that we talked about here, which is ready preparedness and then man. When you look at it, it's going to look like a lot of really manly stuff, but just take a few extra seconds and start clicking on some of those things. And they're like, how do you tie a knot? How do you create impervious cover that's going to stop the, you know, nature's elements? How are you going to purify water? How are you going to be able to cut a circle in wood? How are you going to be able to fashion a knife? And it takes time to learn these things, just like it takes time in anything to get good at anything. But there's no time when things go wrong. When things go wrong, you always look back and think about what you should have done or what you could have done and wish that you would have.
Right.
But in that moment, you have either prepared for it or you haven't. and you don't get to go back in time and put things in place. You know, you said it yourself, like, it's probably not a good time to start a garden. As a matter of fact, there were some states that outlawed you even being able to go and buy seeds, right. Michigan. So like, one, vote people out that are jerks like that, because, you know, like, that's insanity. And two, prepare.
Well, and to that end, right? Like, you know, one thing I talk about a lot, at least on Twitter, is, you know, gun sales going through the roof, right? And that, you know, folks here in the Bay Area, they have this really kind of false thinking that nobody here, that everybody here is anti-gun establishment, right? And the truth is, if you look at gun sales here, they are going through the roof, just like they're going through the roof in any other state. If you go to a gun store in the Bay Area, they're out of ammo, just like everybody else. They're out of every gun, just like everybody else. What does that tell you? It tells you that everybody here is buying a gun. But the problem is, my fear about the majority of people that I meet that end up buying the guns is, I ask them, when was the last time you pulled your gun out? And they'll be like, well, the day that I bought it and brought it home. And that, to me, is a very scary person that has a gun, because I think people need to recognize that with that decision to buy a firearm comes a deep responsibility of knowing how to use it, when to use it, and how to not allow it to get taken away from you, rather, even, and could potentially get used against you and your family, right? Like, all of these different things. And, you know, it's like, that's, I think, one of these things that people think, that they go out and buy a gun and there you go, that's the end of their problems, right? Like, nothing's going to hurt them after that because now they have it. And I almost feel like it's more dangerous, not almost, I absolutely feel like it's more dangerous that they just go out and buy a gun and they have it sitting around with zero training than had they never gotten one to begin with.
Yeah, owning a firearm, there's responsibility that goes with it. The responsibility about how to store it safely to make sure, like, you can go through my, Tim Kennedy, who, a Special Forces sniper, a Green Beret, you know, countless tours overseas, Iraq, Afghanistan. There's not a single gun in my whole entire home that is not secured, locked up in a very protected way, to one, protect myself, but most importantly, to protect my family members. And then I spend, I don't know, 10 hours a week training with that firearm.
10 hours a week. That's serious. That's serious work.
Yeah. It's not shooting all the time. Sometimes I'm practicing how to load it and unload it and how to clear it and how to draw it and how to move with it. And, you know, we call that dry firing. We're just practicing how to do a specific piece of that pie so that when I put that whole thing together, it flows well. And that responsibility is one of the, like, when you got your driver's license, like, hey, you got your driver's license. Good for you. Now you have a car. And if you go and park that car and you don't drive it for 5 years, and then you go and think that you're going to go out there and you've never driven before besides the day that you got that permit,
you're going to be a shitty driver.
You're going to be a really shitty driver, and you could really hurt somebody. And that's unacceptable. That is not responsible. It's the opposite of responsible. That's you being an asshole.
Right.
So, you have to be responsible gun owner.
Yeah. And I think that's like a huge key that, you know, I think people want to have their heads buried in the sand in a lot of places as to who really is going out and purchasing guns. And I think that when people feel uneasy that they are in a safe place, and they will go out and buy a gun. But the problem is, I don't see nearly the amount of people buying guns training with those guns. And I think that they need.
I see that. So, you know, we run, let's see, 40, 60. We have about 200 to 400 clients every single month that come to our shooting courses. And 4 years ago, you know, these were like the typical New Mexico survivalist, right? They own. It's, what was that movie, Tremors, with the underground snake things?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you broke into the wrong goddamn rec room. Dude had like 60 guns on his wall. Like, I had a bunch of clients that were just like that.
Right.
Now, I have somebody that shows up with the sticker still on their gun. It's still in the plastic. It's still in the cellophane. It's never been touched. It's never been shot. It's never been opened. And I applaud them that they're there. I welcome them with open arms. And then I dedicate a single instructor to that one person because that person is so dangerous.
Right. They need it the most.
Yeah. But for the first time in, you know, I've been doing this almost my whole entire adult life. We have so many of those people in every single one of those courses, and thank God that they're coming and getting trained, and welcome to the side of freedom for owning a firearm. But you have to recognize the responsibility and the danger of owning a firearm and treat it accordingly.
One thing that I really loved that you talked about on Rogan the last time you were on there is the fact that you really have no idea why people kind of exercise the right to open carry rather than conceal and carry. And I thought that that was such an interesting point that, you know, I had never thought of, which is like, it's dangerous because you lose your advantage of, you know,
surprise.
Of surprise, right? Which is, yeah. And that I had never thought about that before, right? Like I've lived in Vegas before, right? And there are certain counties in Nevada that I guess you call them like cowboy rules, where you can like carry it on your side, and you see all these like guys at, you know, at certain rallies having, you know, weapons, you know, hanging around them or on their outside, and it is weird, right? Because you're kind of like, well, I mean, everybody knows exactly what you're working with right now, and that's kind of problematic. Don't you think that you wouldn't want some element of tactical kind of advantage there? And it's funny because you see those people who are so, you know, desperately trying to show you everything they have, but yet you're also looking at their physique and you're like, I don't know, man. You're like, you look like you completely live on bologna sandwiches, and you're like, what, this is such a strange paradox, right?
Yeah. You know, the open carry thing is a weird paradox. You know, the having law enforcement on the street is a natural deterrence. If I'm in the valley of Afghanistan and there's Taliban up on the mountaintops and they're shooting down at me, and I call in for an aircraft to come and fly by, we call it a show of force. That aircraft will come and do a show of force, and like cockroaches running from the light, they will run into every crevice and cavern they could possibly can to get away from that show of force. So I get the deterrence element, and I understand, and I'm acknowledging that, you know, somebody having a gun, definitely there's an element to deterrence. But as a professional gunfighter that has killed people my whole entire adult life, that person that is open carrying a gun to me does not deter any real predator. The people that really want to do harm will go somewhere else to do it, or they will kill that person first. And that's what real predators do, is they look for weak prey for them. To, you know, like a lion isn't sitting there and being like, all right, which wildebeest is the biggest, the fastest, and the strongest? They're like, all right, which is the one that gives me the easiest and best meal? And that's how predators work. So yeah, I carry a gun everywhere I go, and I've never in what, 20, 30 years, 20 years of carrying a gun, I've never open carried.
Yeah. Well, it was something that I'd never thought of or heard, you know, kind of framed in that way. And obviously, you know, you would know. So listen, I appreciate all your time here. I do want to kind of let people know, like, you know, where they can find you at, because, you know, once I started kind of following Sheepdog Response, I do have to give a shout out to my cousin, Josh, on this, because like Josh is probably like one of your biggest fans, and like he and I geek out on stuff that you guys put out there, and our dream one day is to come visit you guys and do some of your courses through Sheepdog Response and just kind of maybe go hunting with you one day. But tell like the average folks out there, like where they can find you, what all your kind of handles are, and the best way to follow you.
So Tim Kennedy MMA on Instagram, Tim Kennedy on YouTube, Tim Kennedy MMA on Facebook. You know, like look, they're all verified accounts. You know, they have like a million followers here. So like it's, there's no other accounts. There's no like private accounts. There's no side accounts. It's just, me. And then Sheepdog Response is our defensive tactics training company. And, we have a cool, we have a mentor, a young men's mentorship called Apogee Strong. And it's one of the things that we were talking about earlier. The whole point of that mentorship is to kind of put the man back in masculinity. And it is a gentle, caring process of us trying to give young men tools to be successful at life. And that's another place that I'm spending quite a bit of time these days.
And so is it like a camp, like a summer camp, or what is it?
We do in-person summits, but it's actually, kind of a daily and weekly, like, okay, show us your, workout journal. You know, if you are overweight, okay, show us your diet journal. If you are aspiring to be a police officer, okay, did you do research in current law around this topic? We'll have Socratic conversations about things that are happening, like the George Floyd, trial that's going on right now. We had a conversation about that. Okay. Like right, wrong. And there's lots of varying degrees of gray in between those two. And we talked about all of them, you know, like there's not a good actor in anything in there. And that was one of the coolest things, was hearing these young men, you know, dive into, you know, sometimes they're even their unconscious biases of like, okay, well, why do you think that? And they're identifying there's something wrong, like that. My opinion that I just stated didn't make sense. So now I'm actually having to contradict myself because that was a bias that I just realized. So it's been really cool. And then, yeah, we do in-person, you know, like summits and events where these young men get together and, really put it to the test.
Well, that's awesome, man. So follow, I cannot, if you have any interest in any of the stuff we've talked about, I'm telling you, like, you will enjoy yourself immensely. Following Tim, I believe, truly kind of increases your enjoyment in life. I think the things you post overwhelmingly are about positively improving your life. One of the most fascinating things that I've really enjoyed following recently is your recovery of your knee, because, I mean, just how fast you're pushing it. But kind of you're pushing it in these very, very strategic ways, right? Like through the cuffing, through the blood flow things, and anyone who's interested in kind of, you know, pushing their body to extremes in the sense of training hard, living hard, like being your best self. Tim is an incredible follow and, you know, genuinely a good human, right? And Tim, I wanted to thank you very much for coming on here. I think, you know, obviously you have no other reason to do it besides just the kindness of your heart, you know. So thank you so much. And, you know, I look forward to meeting you in person one day and getting a chance to roll around with you and have you break some of my, you know, some of my crunchy parts.
Man, it'd be my pleasure. Really appreciate your time. And if you come and train with me, then you have to come and help me cook.
Oh, dude, that is a deal. We're going to lock it in. I appreciate you, brother. Great. Thank you so much. Take care.
Yeah. The main ingredient.